From KQED in San Francisco, this is the California Report, the statewide news program focusing on the issues, culture, and public affairs of the Golden State.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On this Labor Day weekend, a conversation with author Michael Pollan. His book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, has people talking about implications of the American diet, the meaning of organic food, and the future of California agriculture.
There are people in the Schwarzenegger administration who have told me that their projections say that there won't be any agricultural land left in the Central Valley by the end of this century.
Also, a Napa Valley connection to the Joy of Cooking cookbook, and he's a high-tech investor by day and a rock band singer by night.
I want to play great music. I don't care if we sell a lot of records, but I care deeply that the people who come here and leave the place going, wow, that was great.
Those stories, plus remembering our history as the epicenter of drag car racing, it's the California Report. I don't know about you, but summer just flew by for me this year. Not sure why it felt that way, but it's almost Labor Day, and, well, we're heading to Mendocino this weekend, and then summer's pretty much done. It was a season of sticker shock at gas pumps. $3 plus for a gallon of regular. It's come down a bit now, but still makes you think about how far you're driving and how much it's going to cost. Maybe it was the price of gas and airline tickets, or maybe just wanting to avoid the hassles of airports and long security lines. But it seems many Californians stayed a little closer to home this summer.
Rick Miller from Martinez. I went to Big Sur for a four-day weekend. For the first time. It was real beautiful and really enjoyed myself. I would have probably traveled farther, but we pretty much just stayed in the area this summer because of the oil prices.
Of course, this is California, so you gotta use your car sometimes, especially if you live in the Central Valley, like Fresno high school teacher Kevin Oates. But he says his gas money is going toward his car and his new boat.
It used to be that we'd want to go out every weekend, and towards the end of the summer, once August kind of rolled around, we really backed off on how much we were using the boat just because of the money factor. We got to pay our PG&E bill, can we afford to go boating this weekend? You know, is really what it came down to.
And in Grass Valley, east of Sacramento, Melissa Willits decided she didn't have to take her children that far to have fun.
I mostly just stayed locally and went to different spots on the river with the kids. I'm a single mom, and the money is budgeted accordingly throughout the year. So when gas prices went up and my youngest son decided he'd play football, we had more things to add into the budget, and we ate a lot of chicken and rice this summer, making that budget.
The price of oil and gasoline, conflict in the Middle East, war in Iraq, those things might not seem connected to what we eat, but maybe they are. In his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, author Michael Pollan argues that the American diet, the choices we make at mealtime, has a lot to do with everything else that's happening in the world.
The food issue is connected to many of those other issues. If you just take one thread and pull on it, you'll see. Let's take the thread of energy. We are in the Middle East in large part because of energy, and one of the great sinks for energy in this country, about a fifth of the fossil fuel that we use in this country, is to produce food. I don't think people realize just how much fossil fuel it takes to produce, you know, a meal at McDonald's. So that's one connection. There is, I think, other connections. I think food is a national security issue. It's not often talked about in those terms. It will be when the energy runs out, and it will be when that inevitable terrorist attack on the food supply comes, something the government has been worried about and warning of for quite a while. When you have a very highly centralized national food chain such that, say, a single hamburger grinding plant is feeding 500,000 Americans hamburgers in 1 week, as we do, the contamination of one node in that food chain, say that hamburger grinding plant, could sicken a vast number of Americans. And any country genuinely concerned about the security of their food supply would be working very hard to decentralize that system.
What are some of the vulnerabilities in that system here in California?
We have a high-energy food supply here in California because we are dependent on very distant markets. We ship our broccoli across the country. We ship our lettuce across the country. So there is a great vulnerability in the fact that most of our the food we grow in this state is exported, and often long distances. And, of course, there is the vulnerability of the water supply. But I would say one of the big threats to California agriculture, and perhaps the biggest in the near term, is development. Protecting this incredibly precious farmland in the Central Valley, some of the best growing land in the world, from houses, from highways, is, I think, going to be the big challenge of the next for the rest of this century.
It seems like your book and this discussion is part of a bigger conversation about what is organic and what is the value of organic when it's produced in such large quantities.
Well, you're exactly right. There's a serious debate taking place over whether this industrialized organic products that are now available and increasingly will be available everywhere are organic in the kind of small O meaning of the word. And if you go back to some of the founding principles of organic, there was a very strong emphasis on local small farms, fresh seasonal food, not food that was flown all over the country and all over the world. That said, you know, there's a lot of good to be said for industrializing organic. The fact is that even if you're selling your lettuce, you know, halfway around the world, the field where it is grown is not being sprayed with toxic pesticides. The workers working in those fields are not being exposed to those carcinogens. The water downstream of those farms is going to be cleaner, and that's all very valuable. And I think we risk getting into a black and white either-or situation that industrial organic is evil, local food is good, and that's it. And I think it's more complicated than that.
Walmart, which is kind of the poster child for bad corporate citizenship, of course, is talking about selling more organic food. What do you make of that?
It's another one of these developments that's neither good nor bad. It's probably both. You know, it would be easy to just attack it as greenwashing or fakery. But from what I can see, that they are serious about this. And I think they may be somewhat naive about it, too, and how easy it is to do to sell organic food that cheaply. I think they're going to be quite surprised. But it's a good thing in this sense. Organic food, which has been open to the charge of being elitist for years and years and years because it costs considerably more than conventional food, will no longer. Because when Walmart is selling organic food for 10% more than their already dirt cheap conventional food, and that's the claim that of what they're going to do, organic food will not be elitist food anymore. Just about everybody will be able to afford it. And that's a wonderful, encouraging democratization of organic food. But you then have to ask the next question, which is, how are they going to do that? What are they going to do to organic food to get the price down? Well, either they're going to squeeze their suppliers, something we know they're very good at, and they're going to put organic growers in the same boat that conventional growers have been in for years and years and years, which is selling very low profit, if any profit, commodities to big companies and barely getting by. Or they're going to outsource it, and they're not going to buy it from California, and they're going to get their produce from China. And I think there's a lot of signs that China's going to step up to the plate and start growing a lot of organic produce. And that is a real challenge to us.
Well, Michael Pollan, thank you so much for talking to us.
My pleasure, Scott. It's good to be here.
Michael Pollan is a professor at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. His latest book is called The Omnivore's Dilemma. Irma Rombauer's Joy of Cooking is the Bible of the American kitchen. Generations of people have learned to cook with it, their first lesson in poaching salmon or scenting a dish with saffron. Most people don't realize there's a California connection to the joy of cooking, the Rombauer Winery nestled along Napa Valley's winding Silverado Trail. Polly Stryker explains.
Irma Rombauer's grandson, Ethan Becker, makes his home in Tennessee. He visits the winery each year for an event called The Joy of Wine, thrown by his cousin and winery owner, Kerner. They took a break from bottling Chardonnay the day before the event to talk with me about the cookbook that began as a way to make money in the Great Depression.
My grandmother was the wife of an attorney, and she was recently widowed. and she had a few thousand dollars left and decided to write a cookbook because a society lady that she knew had written a cookbook when she said, I can do better than that. But she took the money that she had, she took half of it, wrote the book, and sold it mail order from her apartment in St. Louis.
Ethan, who looks a little like Santa Claus, told me that he loved going to his grandma's house, in part for the baked goodies. She also had a fine sense of humor and drank a cocktail every afternoon. But was Irma Rombauer a good cook?
She was actually not very well known as a cook, but as a hostess. One of her aunts said to her at one point, Irma, if you write a cookbook, who would buy it?
15 million copies later, The Joy of Cooking is given to nearly every newlywed in America. I asked Ethan, who's billed as co-author along with his mother and grandmother, why it did so well.
See, before you had appliances, they were much more likely to have a cook and a maid in a middle or upper middle class household. And then the Depression came along, and all of a sudden nobody had servants anymore. A lot of people suddenly were discovering that they had to learn what was going on in their own kitchens. And Irma was right there. The timing was good.
It was more than just timing. The language in The Joy of Cooking doesn't talk down to people. And as anyone who's used it knows, it tells you what to do when your sauce curdles.
I think that the biggest thing is the tone has always been a friendly tone. You know, you got a question? Ask Irma. And even though Irma died in 1962, people are still asking, what would Irma say, even though it was my mother or it was me?
Ethan began working on the family cookbook in his 20s and attended Le Cordon Bleu in France. Even so, he's had plenty of bloopers in the test kitchen, like the time when the pot roast tasted like a paper bag smells.
I still remember the pot roast in a bag fiasco. Not everything works. You get ideas, you hear about things, and you try things. And sometimes they work, and sometimes you got to call in pizza.
The Joy of Cooking is about to come out with its 75th anniversary edition. That's 7 decades of American food trends, from the electric rotisserie fad of the 60s to bison burgers. Ethan talked about what's new in this version.
We're bringing back the game chapter. We have a new section on hearth cooking. Whenever people have a wood fire, why aren't they using it to cook on? To me, nothing adds flavor to food like a wood fire does, because you can go from nothing to nuclear and just moving the pan just slightly.
The new edition will be around 1,200 pages, and space has always been an issue. Ethan looked pained when talking about how a recipe makes the cut.
At one point, I think we discovered that there were like 8 boiled cabbage recipes. Okay, so you say, okay, when was the last time anybody was served or served to anyone boiled cabbage? If you get a big fat zero around the table, then you chop a bunch of boiled cabbage recipes out and put in chimichurri.
He drives around the country widely, sampling food from coast to coast.
It's very safe to say that because of California, and because of California wines, that there are a lot more recipes in the book that use wine. If I could, I'd buy the other half of Kerner's Mountain and live here part of the year, because I love California cuisine. I love California. To me, the produce is just the most wonderful resource you all have out here.
Ethan's cousin Kerner, who owns the Rombauer Winery, is a retired pilot with kind eyes and a steady handshake. He isn't involved in writing the cookbook, but finds it a terrific icebreaker.
Having gone through the book and used it has made life a lot easier for Rombauer on the wine side of things, to make people comfortable early on in starting to talk about the wines and how we do things around here.
Ethan signs battered family copies of The Joy of Cooking at the Rombauer's annual wine event. The cousins rarely cook together for such a foodie family. Kerner told me that Ethan likes to do the cooking, and then cited the old adage about too many cooks in the kitchen. For the California Report, I'm Polly Stryker.
Not that long ago, Southern California was the center of the drag racing world. The Southland was home to more than a dozen drag strips, from Lyons and Long Beach and Irwindale Raceway to the most fabled of them all, the quarter-mile track at the Pomona Speedway, home of the annual Winter National Championship. A new photo exhibit called Faster chronicles the dragsters that brought speed and fame to Pomona and the photographers who tried to freeze them in time. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas has more.
Now here we go. This should be a real race for the money coming to the line.
February 1962. It's the Winter National Championship drag races at the Pomona Speedway. A pair of Top Fuel dragsters rumble to the starting line. They're outfitted with 7,000 horsepower engines that burn up a gallon and a half of nitromethane every second. They'll roar down Pomona's quarter-mile track at speeds in excess of 300 miles per hour. If you're a photographer and you blink, you miss the shot.
The 1960s drag racing at Pomona was a moment of standoff between two technologies that are central to Southern California, cars and cameras.
Douglas McCullough is the curator of the Faster exhibit.
So what you see is cars getting faster at an incredible rate. Meanwhile, the cameras were relatively primitive. There were no long zoom lenses. There was no, 35 millimeter cameras of a really usable sort. So they would have to have certain tactics and certain positions, and they would have to know what's going to be coming at them and have the timing exactly right so that they could shoot at the one moment they were going to get.
McCullough, who's also curator at the California Museum of Photography at UC Riverside, spent months digging through tens of thousands of black and white photos shot at the Pomona Speedway. They're part of the National Hot Rod Association archive. He cherry-picked 40 of them, which are now on display here at the NHRA Motorsports Museum in Pomona, alongside several vintage dragsters that survived the quarter-mile track. The photos were shot for gearhead magazines like Hot Rod, but few have ever been published. The ones Doug McCullough chose to exhibit are not your typical shots of burning rubber.
They aimed at everything else as well. They aimed at other photographers. They aimed at the crowds. They aimed at a group of people from out of town wearing Detroit Dragway jackets and people climbing telephone poles to get a view from outside. So it captures a wide range of what drag racing is about, not just the races, but drag racing culture.
In one picture, we see a dragster from above, whooshing through the frame, a blur of road, rubber, and steel. The unusual bird's eye view gives you a glimpse into the cockpit. The driver is hunched over the tiny steering wheel, teeth clenched.
In this case, it's a flathead, classic slingshot dragster, mostly in the frame, except the front left-hand wheel is cut off, the front right-hand wheel is kind of going out of the edge, and the whole thing is a kind of a blur of speed. So he's somewhere along trackside on a ladder, and he's waiting for this car that is by this time going 150 miles an hour and gaining speed. And in the struggle to grab it is the tension of this photograph.
We were such amateurs. We don't know what we're doing. We just go out and do it.
Dick Wells was the editor of National Dragster magazine and later worked for Hot Rod. The photographers, which included Wells, got little sleep, less pay, and no credit. Virtually all the pictures that ran in Hot Rod magazines back then ran without bylines.
Because if you don't like it, you can leave. We've got 10 guys in line who'd love to have that job, and they'll happily work for what we're paying you. That was just management, because management was not made up of enthusiasts. The administrative end of it, those weren't enthusiasts, those were businessmen.
The photographers who shoot drag racing love drag racing. They love the cars, they love the technology, they love the track, they love the history, they love the fans.
Again, Faster curator Douglas McCullough.
It's amazing to have a whole giant set of photographs that are united by kind of this universal involvement and love of something. These photographers weren't just shooting something, they were part of this.
Faster, 1960s photographs of Pomona drag racing is on view now at the National Hot Rod Association Motorsports Museum in Pomona. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
Here they come. Jim Nelson getting the push start first. Coming to the line. His supercharged dodge.
And that'll do it. The California Report for this week, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Paul Lancour is behind the controls this week with additional engineering by Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. This week we say goodbye and thanks to our interns, Lyra Frederick, Anna Sussman, and Alicia Bell. Our producers are Victoria Malleone and Erica Kelly. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Susan Kennedy is our managing editor. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Have a great Labor Day weekend. We'll see you next week. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, committed to improving California's healthcare delivery and financing systems, on the web at chcf.org. And the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995.